success is about learning. It's about understanding what does and doesn't work. And more often than not, success is only rewarded if we can prove that there's an ROI or a commercial value to it. But there's a different side to success, which is actually learning what doesn't work. And most of our organizations don't reward quote unquote failure. The market doesn't reward failure. But that is where the biggest lesson actually comes. You don't learn what you did right if something works the first time. You only learn what not to do in order to recalibrate if you fail.
So you're a smart business committed to innovation, to service, and to modern marketing. And you're asking, what's next? Wondering how you can become even more innovative. My name is Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and this is the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we share all kinds of tips, advice, and interview guests on all things innovation and leadership in modern marketing. Hi, innovators. It's really great to be back with another episode. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. I'm excited to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest today, Gela Boskovic. Gela is a self-proclaimed fintech fanatic. She's also founder of Femtech Global, who sponsored the annual Women in Tech Banking Technology Award. Gela is an advocate of nurturing customer lifetime value for both banks and those they serve, and she is a confirmed evangelist for adopting technology to transform the financial services industry for the greater good. Gela is also a regular contributor to fintech publications. She's a frequent speaker at industry events, and she does a lot of work around the culture of technology and making that more empathetic. Today's episode is brought to you by the Transformational Marketing Hub, where you'll find a host of free and exceptionally useful information to help you transform your marketing. You can access the Transformational Marketing Hub by visiting innovabiz.co/VIP. Very important, people. If you don't yet have an account, click the blue Take a Peek Inside button and check it out. As I said, it's free and exceptionally useful, and especially for you. In our discussion today, Gela talked to me about really knowing what you are and where you are at before deciding what you now want to do. She told me about focusing less on the doing and more on the being in relation to solving a real problem and keeping that in mind during that project. And she explained why we should all return to our terrible twos. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Gela Boskovic. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from London in the United Kingdom, Gela Boskovic. Now, Gela is a self-proclaimed fintech fanatic. She's the founder of Femtech Global, a network dedicated to challenging the status quo and improving the inclusiveness and diversity in the financial services industry. Femtech Global also sponsors the annual Women in Tech Banking and Technology Award. Gela is an advocate of nurturing customer lifetime value for both banks and those that they serve, and she's a confirmed evangelist for adopting technology to transform the financial services industry for the greater good. So with all that said, welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Gela. It's a privilege to have you as a guest.
Thank you, Jürgen. I'm really excited to have a chat today.
Yeah, Pete Trainer, who was on episode 148 of the podcast, suggested that we speak to Gela. So a big hello to Pete. And Gela, you're also a regular contributor to fintech publications. You're a speaker at industry events. You do a lot of work around the culture of technology and making that more empathetic, which is something I'm really looking forward to unpack some more along with all the other things that you're involved in. But before we start talking about all those things, technology, culture, and femtech, let's find out a bit more about you as a person. So how did you get to where you are today, and what were some of the pivotal moments in that journey?
So it's been a full circle kind of career track for me. I started out after graduate school working with utility commission regulators and doing cost models. So worked on the FCC hybrid proxy cost model. It was a benchmark cost proxy model is what they called it, after the 1996 deregulation of the telecommunications industry in the United States, and worked on some projects with the Japanese regulators as well post their deregulation, and started off doing cost modeling, and found myself sucked into the world of compliance and regulation and fascinated with policy and how one policy has a ripple effect across the entire industry. But coming full circle after a little bit of a deviation into looking into fine arts and art history and playing around with some additional grad work, I actually got recruited back into technology and regulatory framework. I was working at Oracle with the insurance global business unit, looking more at customer relationship management and customer lifetime value, but started working with a friend of mine in the financial services global business unit. And when he happened to leave Oracle, he went to a particular company called Zafin, which is a dynamic pricing solution. I was tapped to join him to help develop the market, and I went back into pricing and cost modeling and looking at, instead of utilities, looking at financial products across the entire spectrum, from retail products to global transaction service products and treasury services, cash management, all the way across to asset management and wealth management products as well. And found myself incredibly fascinated with financial services as a regulated industry. It's highly regulated, especially post-2008. It was really interested in the effect of pricing, just pricing in general, and ended up getting sucked into that world that also exposed me not just to financial products and the market itself, but also looking at how technology is playing a role in improving efficiencies or improving the customer experience. And so for the last 10 years or so, I've just been absolutely fascinated by the market, by the technology that is created and deployed, and certainly by the mindset of the industry as it started to shift and embrace this disruptive force of new technology. Disruptive in the sense that it really makes everybody uncomfortable for their particular position and not knowing what their future stake in or role in the industry happens to be. But I started out cost modeling, ended up getting sucked into the world of cost modeling, and now actually find myself also working with several regulators around the globe in how to implement technology in order to improve systemic risk or reduce systemic risk, and to also, effectively, it's a pricing game at the end of the day. How do we price the value of the services that we deliver, especially since it's around money, which is a fascinating topic in and of itself. So it kind of led full circle, and I found that I ended up starting out and have found that it has impacted my entire career, and I've come back to it in such a way that I'm on the other side of that coin. But it's been pricing and cost modeling and modeling in and of itself that has got me to where I am today.
Well, you mentioned the year 2008, and of course there was a big upheaval there in the financial sector that led to global crisis. And in Australia at the moment, there's been quite a number of pretty dramatic revelations as a result of a royal commission into the banking sector and the financial sector. So there's a lot of upheaval going on there, and I imagine that's going to have repercussions more broadly than just Australia as well. But how does technology play a role in kind of controlling perhaps a little bit more some of the excesses of people that led to issues in 2008 and perhaps are at the core of what's happening in Australia at the moment, or what's being uncovered in Australia at the moment?
I think one of the first things is transparency. So technology actually provides for a distinct level of transparency and oversight, especially for regulators, that hasn't been seen up until now. One of the things that we look at is supervisory technology. So how do regulators actually employ technology to supervise different systems, capital markets, or to look at an individual bank's audit record or audit trail, looking at fraud, looking at anti-money laundering. It's now becoming a little bit more of a reality that we can check in real time what's going on with the system, which has not been the case. Regulators have most often had to be reactive post an event, you know, going to look at what the crisis was. Now we're starting to look at systems that allow us to do instant real-time monitoring, not only with updates on potential, but say fraud alerts or sanctions alerts, but also looking into changing some of the parameters around a compliance measure or around a regulatory principle, that the regulators can then play with those parameters and watch the system in real time. Distributed ledgers or blockchain, a lot of people will have talked about or heard about blockchain, but the way, not necessarily looking at it from a cryptocurrency perspective, but looking at it from a ledger perspective. For example, blockchain is just a ledger. It is just a database. Mm-hmm. And most of the lists that we keep inside banks are just lists of what we have done or pending transactions or reconciliations of those transactions. And being able to do it in real time with an oversight and transparency where a particular transaction has been validated, it has been authorized, and it's been authenticated, a regulator can actually pull real-time reporting from that. Or if they're looking at setting up their own node into this particular in a particular system, they're able to actually change some of the parameters that allow for those validated pieces of work or transactions to be flagged or to be recorded in such a way that they can see them in real time. We're not yet at real-time regulation or oversight, but we're getting there. And technology is enabling us to do this in such a way that we can actually look at systemic risk responsibly. And we're starting to model more of these particular scenarios. So playing with liquidity and monetary policy, looking at capital markets fluctuations, looking at the types of structures of securities and derivatives, looking at the actual value, the real-time value of an asset with depreciation, and having that recorded and understanding what we're financing. One of the major contributors to the crisis was, of course, mortgage-backed securities. And with the era of transparency now on us 10 years later, we're able to actually unpick those securities and look at the actual value of the assets. And instead of packaging really poor risk or really, really risky rated securities in between two end points that actually give it an A rating on the market, we're actually able to unpick that and say, no, this is highly risky. This is also something that is in potential default. We can look at portfolios with much more clarity. We can actually run models on the portfolios and the risk portfolios on the lending side, for example. And as we securitize those things, we're able to actually validate the actual asset value. And that makes a big difference. Makes a very big difference. And the fact that we can actually demand that sort of level of auditing and real transparency, that's very encouraging. One of the things that's also at issue is using artificial intelligence and these sort of automated processes to process transactions. And regulators are actually tasked and a given in the legal standing, at least in Europe, the ability to demand that we can explain some of the black box decisioning and the AI algorithms or these machine learning algorithms mm-hmm. that compound each of the decisions and even the output is the next input for the next calculation or next algorithm, that we're able to actually demand that we can explain the rationale and the reasoning behind the algorithm output and decision making. And that's also in giving them a little bit of a tool or a little bit of a power to demand that we have the transparency and audit fairly. So I think it's really encouraging in terms of what regulators are able to do, that technology is enabling them to do that. And post-crisis, it is all about transparency.
Yeah. That's quite powerful to have that level of transparency. And at the same time, it's a bit scary for, I don't know, for people in various positions of decision-making levels, because even if, you know, even if their intention is good, it's kind of like you feel like somebody's watching over your shoulder all the time and seeing what you're doing. So I know you, you're very focused on thinking about technology in terms of, you know, the human face of that and the mindset and the culture around that. So tell us a little bit about what your thoughts are around, you know, how people feel about having a machine, if you like, their every move.
Well, I think there's a balance there. Privacy is also, for the first time in human history, actually a human right, a civil right. Mm-hmm. At least it's been codified in GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation that's been issued, that is now sort of becoming a de facto global standard.
I think
there's a misunderstanding around the level of transparency versus accountability versus privacy around personal data. In terms of a major global system, a financial system, I think high accountability is incredibly important and transparency matters. And if you're in a position of decision-making, then you should actually have the onus of bearing that responsibility, especially for the salary commensurate of, you know, heading some of these global banks. The thing is, organizations, of course, are composed of a number of different people, and who's held accountable or who's, at the end of the day, prosecutable or liable for an infraction is a very different matter than, you know, for the head of a global bank to have a big brother experience with the regulators. The point is, they actually step into that position to have a responsibility that is accompanied by this level of scrutiny and oversight. They're impacting billions of people's lives every single day. So I don't think that there's a bad correlation between high accountability and oversight and that sort of responsibility and the compensation that's commensurate with it. I think, on the other hand, we're looking at the privacy component for individuals and looking at, you know, individual transactions or desires or digital footprints. And privacy now has become something that we're very concerned with and recognize that the personal identifiable information, what we call PII, in the industry is actually has an incredible capital value to not only the individual who has that data about themselves, but to other organizations. And part of what's being discussed in the industry is actually how to return the power of the data to the individual. And the power lies in the privacy of that data. So there's a different discussion around how do we keep that particular data private and yet allow people to capitalize on it, recognizing that there are two fundamental principles at play here. One is that time and attention are our non-renewable resources, and that everyone is given an equal amount, and yet they're continuing to diminish over time. No matter what happens, they will always be a non-renewable diminishing resource. And in order to capture our time and attention, it requires a level of personalization to get the message to us, or it requires a specific amount of intelligence around that individual's behavior, their psychometric behavior, how they think, how they actually behave, where they are, what their desires are, who they interact with, etc. And it's about now how to return that particular commercialization of that time and attention. We call it marketing for all intents and purposes, is how much does that time and attention have value on the market? And how do we actually enable people to start charging for access to their information or to their data that then in turn actually spends their time? And privacy now has become something that technology is looking at in a very specific line of privacy tech, looking at things, for example, something called zero knowledge proof, ZKP. And that is where two parties who don't know one another, don't trust one another, can actually interact by not sharing their private data, but running the proposition or running a particular proof that a transaction is valid or that a fact is valid, that they can, without sharing data, can validate that something is real and true. Okay. And transact on it. And that's... you know, that starting to put the power of privacy back into people's hands.
Okay. And so I had an experience yesterday, and just let me know if this is what you mean. So I was transacting something through the phone, and the person on the other, and I had to make a payment, and the person on the other end said, I'm connecting you now with our payment gateway, or whatever the term was, but basically it went out to an automated system that then took my credit card information and then alerted the person that I was speaking to that the credit card had been approved. So he didn't get the credit card information, he just got notified that it was okay. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, in theory, that's precisely it. That it has that same particular feel that you don't need to share your credit card number and the PIN for it in order for someone else to validate or someone else to see that a transaction has gone through. It's all about proof these days, and that's what we're trying to generate with some of these technology solutions, is proof of an event or a fact or a transaction that doesn't disclose the details of that transaction to either party. And doesn't reveal sensitive, identifiable information to either party, but says, yes, this is a valid thing. You can move forward with your engagement. And looking at offering an element of anonymity, in that we don't have to share the details, but we can show up as an individual, as an organization, and be validated and our transactions authenticated, that they're stamped with a yes, this is true, this is real, and this will go through. That's what we're looking at. So it's giving people the comfort of knowing that their sensitive information is not being disclosed, nor is the nature of the transaction being disclosed it to anybody who happens to look at it. It just happens to have proof that it exists. And that proof can be held by the two different parties in their respective locations without actually sharing either of their information with one another. You can simply run a proof, and that satisfies. So there's a concern now, I think, especially with some of the breaches that we've seen in terms of being hacked and massive amounts of data going out into the market from different organizations, different retail organizations like, say, Target or Experian, for example. But also the Facebook repeated incidents of disclosure. I mean, there was an article in the paper yesterday about organizations like Microsoft and Spotify and Royal Bank of Canada being considered partners under the Facebook terms and conditions that had access to people's private direct messages, private messages. And that we're now starting to understand that the interconnectedness of different organizations and their technology integration points that allow them to share this sort of information, we're now having to put better, more stringent boundaries around those. And understanding that the level of disclosure some of these organizations are breaching actually puts privacy and the power of data back into the forefront of most people's minds. I think we've been sharing willy-nilly data for the last 10 to 20 years that we didn't understand what the implications were, and now we are. So I think generally I'd be reassured that people are examining the privacy question in much more detail, and looking at ways of encryption or ways of generating proofs that allow us to keep more of that data sensitive. But it's also us as individuals understanding how much we disclose. And in terms of financial services, finance is at the heart of pretty much every transaction that we do. And they have a duty to protect that. They are custodians of our data, and they're highly regulated for a reason. And regulators are recognizing the value of that data and putting more of an onus on financial service institutions to put parameters around their level of disclosure and their data sharing and their data practices that are necessary and important, but also, you know, there is a reassurance there that there's an understanding just how sensitive this is around banking, and privacy in banking is one of the biggest topics that we've come up with in the last couple of years and are addressing now in the industry.
So how do you get involved in all of these changes? What's your role with the people you work with?
Well, part of it's self-insertion. I think if it interests you, you tend to follow your interests. It's actually being interested and then engaging with and showing up in the places where those discussions are happening. So I think part of it is seeing and working with banks on a daily basis. One of the things that I do is literally design pilot experiments for them on that's my day job, is finding use cases within the bank, problems within the bank that they need to address, and then going out to market and looking at technology solutions, nascent emerging technology from startup to scale up to established players, solutions that address or can fix potentially part of this particular problem or use case. And in doing that, you tend to bleed into a number of different areas and cross a number of different paths. And a lot of the conversations that we have with the banks, legal and compliance and regulatory, are always involved in those particular questions. So it's understanding the implication of a particular technology application and how it's being either constrained or how it enables easier compliance or meeting a regulatory mandate. And it's also speaking with the regulators because they're looking at these technologies. How do they actually regulate AI, for example? How do you respond to AI when you don't necessarily understand the decision-making behind it? So as you're exploring AI applications inside of a bank, you actually have to include the regulators and their views on that, because those companies that are providing the services, the technology companies, are also being licensed and regulated. So it's this interesting sort of intersectionality of technology regulation, the financial service provider themselves, the market. And if you're involved with one, you touch all of them. So for me, it's also engaging with the people that are making those decisions around it. Also being familiar with the regulatory landscape and being very comfortable there, since my career grew up in the regulatory landscape. Yeah. So you find yourself interacting with people, the next thing you know, they're attached to organizations that actually regulate. So it's having those conversations, knowing that you're going to be crossing paths with people like that.
That's fascinating. Now, you mentioned experiments and designing and running experiments. And I know something I read piqued my interest that you wrote, which is around measurement of success and how people understand whether they're moving the needle towards the outcome. So tell us a little bit about that, because I think there's an interesting story behind that.
Yeah, so this experimentation that I play with and that I work with people on, it does sort of reshape and reframe what success looks like. And one of the things that is sort of a maxim in innovation is it's not innovation unless it's profitable, it produces a commercial output. And the success that we measure is typically only around that commercial output. And success of an experiment is only about it being deployable, scalable, and capitalized. So if we're making a particular operational change or a process change in the back office systems where a customer doesn't experience it, and we can't necessarily look at a measure of profitability, but we have to look at a measure of return on investment, the typical ROI, how much should it save us in our CapEx budgets. That's typically how we start to frame it. And unfortunately, that doesn't actually prove success. Success is about learning. It's about understanding what does and doesn't work. And more often than not, success is only rewarded if we can prove that there's an ROI or a commercial value to it. But there's a different side to success, which is actually learning what doesn't work. And most of our organizations don't reward quote unquote failure.
Yeah.
Market doesn't reward failure, but that is where the biggest lesson actually comes. You don't learn what you did right if something works the first time. You only learn what not to do in order to recalibrate if you fail. And that's one of the things that organizations don't necessarily structure themselves for, is they also don't budget for this experimentation of this learning phase, where something doesn't necessarily work out right, or potentially the product or the customer journey isn't as smooth or as successful as we would like. And yet we do not reward the lesson that comes out of that. And we fail to learn from other people's mistakes because we don't broadcast those mistakes. We don't share them. We don't pool them into a lessons learned that we can capitalize on the lesson learned.
Yeah,
I think that's what's kind of funny.
It's funny, and it's interesting too, because the last three or four podcasts I've chatted with people on completely different topics. And this concept has come up over and over again. Now, the idea of embracing one's own failures or mistakes as a way to help other people. So they're actually a gift that you have that you can give to other people because you can help them understand the learnings from those mistakes. You can help those people understand how not to make those mistakes themselves because you've already done it, so they don't need to repeat the mistakes. So I think it's a really valuable concept. And if I think back, because my background's science, if I think back to the way scientists run experiments, I mean, you put up a hypothesis and then you conduct some experiments to test that hypothesis, and probably 80 to 90% of the time the hypothesis turns out to be wrong. So therefore you can say the experiment failed, but it didn't, because it actually disproved the hypothesis and forced you to come up with an alternative hypothesis, which is how you make progress.
This is precisely it, Jürgen. This is exactly it. And there's a commercial value to those insights, which I think people also fail to realize, is that you can capitalize on the insights that only come from had you not actually experimented. It's also interesting when we start to apply, say, agile methodology to it and looking at an agile approach to addressing a challenge or trying to find a solution or mocking up a solution versus the traditional waterfall approach where, you know, you plan an entire project out and you have benchmark measurements that you then recalibrate at, you know, and it takes 9 months to do something where in 9 days you could have really quickly sketched something out, learned something and moved on. And it's the whole notion of learning and iterating and adapting flexibly to those insights in a very quick fashion that we're now attached to. And that's what innovation is about, agile innovation. People talk about it. We can actually improve on that. But the whole notion is that we're rewarding the insight. And it's not a failure. It's a, like you said, it's just proving that the hypothesis is invalid and we have to go back and find a new hypothesis or come up with a new hypothesis. And that's not necessarily rewarded in big organizations that are risk averse and that move very, very slowly in terms of cultural mindset and cultural shift and daily practices and all sorts of things that it takes to run a big organization. They're more cumbersome. They're more people to get on board for the change. Business process management is a thing because we need to manage them, and it's a complex subject in and of itself. But the point is, we don't reward the insight, and we talk about it as if it's a failure rather than something of value. And that's also a big problem. I think, you know, getting back to this, we actually should be rewarding those insights and call them insights rather than failures. They're lessons learned. And they shortcut the time to actually finding the right solution if we pay attention to them instead of assume that we can plan for all sorts of, you know, potential pitfalls over the course of 9 months and we'll have the perfect thing at the end of it. How many different products or ideas have been gestated for those 9 months and they in and of themselves are flops at the very end of it, even though we planned for every contingency instead of actually testing very, very quickly, validating that we're on the right track, or going back to the drawing board if we prove ourselves wrong, and accepting that the proof of the experiment actually should inform the next step rather than counting on a commercial success of it and only focusing on that particular, you know, key performance indicator.
Yeah, that's great advice, and it's a great approach to take. Now, I know you do a lot around design of experiments, and one of your philosophies is to keep things quite simple, and that ties in perhaps with the agile methodology of quickly deciding whether it's, you know, a lesson to be learned and direction has to be changed or not. So talk to us a little bit more about your design philosophy.
So I think it's a incredibly practical one, which is, maybe the problem that you see is not necessarily the problem that is. Mm. And part of it is we need to fix X. Well, maybe you don't need to fix X. Maybe what you need to do is reject the premise that X is important and realize that Y or N or F or, you know, Z is really where you should be starting. And part of that is going through the requirements gathering stages when people start to talk about a problem statement. This is my fundamental problem, or this is the thing that I would like to solve. More often than not, it's improving a process, doubling down on a product and moving more current product, being able to, you know, save costs and cut out big steps in a particular process, and technology can enable all of those. But at the end of the day, is that what you're really trying to fix, or is that the patch? And part of it is in this designing of experiments is asking for people to be incredibly honest about what their primary motivators are and what they really want to do. And it's getting to this reductivist state of, is this what you fundamentally want to do? What is it that you truly want? And it's not necessarily about solving the problem that's in front of you. It's about addressing something that's much more fundamental. It's much more quality driven rather than action driven. And one of the things that that I believe in terms of not only designing experiments, but in terms of innovation, is you need to know what you are before you know where to compete and where to collaborate and what you actually do. Knowing what you are serves as a guidepost for what you should do. And more often than not, we think about what we need to do rather than what that thing is or what we want to be. So in banking, there are really three fundamental strata that you can play in, and any organization belongs in one of the three. They're either capital, they're infrastructure, or they're the customer experience. And a lot of organizations will try to play in two of those particular strata, or they don't really know where they fit within the strata itself. And they try to be something, or they try to undertake actions and activities that are in direct opposition where they say they want to be and what they serve as in terms of the marketplace. And a lot of the times in organizations, because they're so complex, we also find ourselves not understanding where we are in the strata within the organization and what we are supposed to do, or what our particular state of being ought to be. And we're focused more on the doing. And in a lot of the requirements, we actually, what is the problem you're trying to solve? Is that the actual problem? And we try to validate that or invalidate the assumptions as often as we possibly can. So I guess in terms of design theory, it's probably playing devil's advocate. It's fundamentally playing devil's advocate and asking what the root state of being is that we want to solve for, rather than the activities or the structure around it that we think exists or assume exists that we need to play with. There's another one of my kind of innovation truths that I subscribe to, which is analytical thinking makes an ass out of you and me. Assumption, right? It's because, you know, a traditional logic, you make assumptions of what the rules are. And if you can imagine a maze, you start from point A to B and you work your way through the maze. And the line is quite squiggly. It can go any direction. It will turn logically to find the exit. But that makes an ass out of us because we're assuming that there are particular rules in place. Instead, I say, let's try to embrace this thing, this lateral thinking, where we disregard implied rules. And if we were to imagine again a maze, instead of going through the maze from point A to B, we literally go around the maze and draw a line from A to B outside of the box. And this is kind of the imagery that I think of outside of the box thinking is precisely that. It's lateral thinking. It's disregarding the rules that we think are implied or assumed. And when I talk about the state of being, or when I talk about playing devil's advocate, it's challenging each and one of those assumptions about the rules that we assume are there, either our ability to consume technology or deploy it, our assumptions of whether the market will respond to it or a customer will like it, or what the rules and processes and requirements are that we think are in place because we've always done it this way and we sort of built a framework around this way that we're comfortable with, and we assume that that's how the world operates. And that's the point of, you know, so this assumption, this sort of analytical thinking that makes fools out of all of us is precisely that, because You know, when you assume, it makes an ass out of you and me. And that's exactly what we're doing. We're assuming that there are frameworks and guideline rules that apply that we don't challenge, we don't test, and we continue to operate in that happy little bubble of an artificial framework that does us no good and moves the needle in no way.
One of the most powerful questions, I think, is what if, you know, and applied in the sense of if somebody says, well, X, therefore Y, because Z. And if the question then is, well, what if Z didn't matter? Or what if X didn't happen because of Y? You know, and you always see people kind of, that just stumps them.
it does, doesn't it?
The assumptions are so ingrained that they kind of have to really work, their mind is working overtime to try and figure out, disassociate the two things that they've assumed belong together and figure out what could be if it wasn't the case.
Yeah, it's that constant question of, well, why? Why does it matter? Why do you think that? I remember my father telling me the two most powerful things in the world, or the two phrases that would trump everything, were first and foremost, why? Yeah. And the second was, prove it. And he rues the day that he taught me those things, because I used them against him, clearly. But it served me well. And it's the same thing in terms of designing an experiment. It is, we're assuming a lot of things are there, are in place, or that we have to do it this way, or it's not possible to do it any other way. And the whole point of designing the experiment is to challenge those assumptions, is why do you think this has to be this? Or why are you assuming or concluding or arguing for this point? Justify it, rationalize it, we'll question the rationality, and we'll do that until we get to the root cause. So it does fundamentally come back to, what do you want? What is it you want to be? So then we can start designing what we need to do. And the being is always based on, or the doing is always based on, a number of assumptions that we think we need to get to the being. So if we challenge that and devil's advocate it and throw out all of the implied rules and literally give a tabula rasa that says, if you didn't have these things in place in your current organization, how would you do it differently? And even though that's an exercise sometimes in futility, because people can't divorce themselves, we get them thinking about that assumed framework and start to challenge those rules. It's challenging the establishment. You know, damn the man, the current man, as it is in the framework of the architect, and drawing the human being from scratch again.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, the question why is something that I think, you know, it's so fundamental to learning, because anyone that's been a parent or had a lot to do with young children, when they get to about 2 years old, they bombard you with why, and they will not let up. They will keep asking why, and doesn't matter how many answers you give, they'll keep asking why. And unfortunately, we all get it drummed out of us at some point, because as the two-year-old just drives the parents up the wall, and then they stop it, which is unfortunate, because that's how they're learning. That's, you know, they're trying to figure out the world.
Exactly. I think we should all return to our terrible twos.
Yeah.
Right? I remember I have a couple of nephews, and I remember one time spending a lunch hour with them, and the oldest of the nephews, he had learned about a couple of natural disasters in school that day, but had more questions. And his mom said, well, why don't you save those for your auntie? And, you know, you can still answer those. And the kid says to me, so Auntie Gellett, what makes a tornado? Why do tornadoes happen? And of course, I have no actual idea other than there is barometric pressure and temperatures, and you know, it all, I know it has something to do with the atmosphere. So I pulled the phone out, thank heavens for that, and we started Googling the answers and pictures, and it led to what makes an earthquake. At least I can talk about tectonic plate shifting that much, you know, that works. And that's the volcanoes. And then it was all of these different things that we spent an afternoon together, where he pulled out the paper and the crayons and he wanted to draw and he wanted to capture what he'd just learned on paper. And then he wanted to tell a story about it. And his younger brother climbed into my lap and said, me too. I want to know why. Yeah. And it's that same sort of curiosity. Curiosity is a moral virtue. And the curiosity of why do we assume something or why do we do it this way is a moral virtue. And I think it is true what my father said is why is the most important thing you could possibly ask. And it's the most incredibly sharp rapier that cuts through all of the shenanigans and the fluff and gets to the heart of the matter. And the big questions and the existential questions of why we exist and why an organization exists in the first place, why a business exists, what problem you actually solve, what is it that you do that makes things better is only answered by why. And we very rarely are able to articulate why and what. We can always articulate how, because those are the actions that we do and those are the things that we're comfortable with. But we can never really articulate the what and the why. And those are the two crucial things. And I think in an organization, anytime we start to plan for a change or we start to tinker with what were our business model, and we should always be tinkering with our business model, by the way, and understanding that we should be thinking about what replaces what we currently do. I think that's the other thing that we forget is what we do today is not going to be in demand tomorrow. And we need to be aware of shifting that and being able to cannibalize our own current revenue streams with something new that we build constantly to replace it. We challenge the assumptions of why we do what we do and why it will satisfy a need today when the need will change tomorrow. How do we close that gap? That's the best thing that we could possibly do is why. And play the terrible two, you know, the two-year-old, and consistently challenge our assumptions.
Bring back that insatiable curiosity.
Yes, yeah, it is a moral virtue.
All right, this is fascinating. I could keep going for ages, but I did want to touch on FemTech and get you to tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, sure. So FemTech started because we were trying to find good women speakers in the industry. And it actually came out of an organization called InnoTribe, which is the innovation arm of one of the staples of the financial services world, which is SWIFT. SWIFT helps with the messaging for payments and transactions, and every single bank across the globe uses SWIFT. And InnoTribe is their innovation arm. But they were looking at women in the industry, looking at sort of who the power players were, who they could get to speak, who we would actually, you know, start to listen to. And they were challenged to come up with a list of 400. And it was very difficult. 400 women in the industry of tens of thousands of people who serve. And so we started looking at that particular gap and looking at the voices of women in the industry. And it frustrated me in part because most of the people that I actually collaborate with are incredibly dynamic, powerful, insightful women. And maybe that's just a default of my network. But I also felt that representation was beyond skewed. And I'm a firm believer in taxation with representation rather than without. That principle of you don't get to determine my framework without my say-so, especially for sort of this democratic notion of a society or a structure. And so it became a matter of how do we connect women to women? How do we mentor? How do we foster sort of the career path? But also, how do we allow them to have the voice? Because when we start looking at facts and figures of how women play a role in financial services, there's some interesting things to uncover, one of which is 80% of any financial decision is actually made by a woman. 80% of household financial decisions are made by women, irrespective of the household being, you know, married couple, single parent, etc. The other thing is women also have an incredible amount of discretionary income. And we have higher levels of discretionary income than men for a number of reasons. But we're looking at some $20 trillion amongst women alone on the market of capital to be spent in discretionary funds. And the size of the market is incredible. And yet none of the products are actually tailored for women. or have been, we've had access to them. In some countries, up until 1975, 1980, we still had to have a man sign for a checking account. And yet we make the financial decisions 80% of the time.
Yeah.
So looking at that, you know, and in terms of success of companies, that when you have 25% of your board as female, that there's a tipping point that you actually have a massive improvement on ROI and ROE, 47% improvement on return on equity, for example. And we're looking up to, you know, 63% improvement in ROI when you have a gender balanced board or gender balanced exco. There's an improvement in sales revenue when you have diversity of salespeople. For every 1% increase in diversity of ethnic diversity or racial diversity, you actually can see an uptake in 15% of sales revenue. And when it's gender diversity, it's around 9 to 10% of uptake in sales revenue. And women-led companies tend to outperform. Even, I mean, the operational efficiencies are improving. So women have a fundamental place in the business sense of it, but we're underrepresented, or our voices are not heard. And so the initiative behind FemTech was to actually talk about the need for diversity, not just from an ethical or moral stance of being inclusive of people that are different, but also from a business perspective, that there's a business case for having a diverse team. There's the Nash experiment, for example, is something that has been repeated over and over, but it was late 60s, early 70s when it had its peak. It's about group conformity and groupthink, and that you can put a person in into a group, and the peer pressure alone will automatically urge them to conform with the same consensus. And that actually makes for bad decision making. So if you're organizing yourself with homogeneous groups, or a group of the same sort of people day in and day out, that groupthink and decision making decreases. That you're again putting, you know, a series of framework, an assumption framework around yourself that are challenged. And that the diversity of thinking and diversity of discussion around the table actually can improve decision making. And in terms of long-term complex decision making, there's research on that proves that you actually needed a range and diversity of ideas that come from a number of different people that are outside of the decision that you're actually making, that their viewpoint or that their knowledge, their historical understanding of a particular thing can have an incredible impact on what you choose to do that will show up 10 years later, that impact will show up 10 years later. So there is practical need for diversity in organizations, and there's a practical need for understanding how the market plays out because it's composed of diverse people and we're only designing for a very select few. So it started because diversity actually improves everything across the board, from decisions to design to business revenues, efficiencies. But it also, when we start to include people that have been excluded from financial services, it increases the market. And it also happens to have a nice impact on people's daily quality of life, that we actually can bring them into a system that allows them access to a bigger market. But the size of the market itself actually improves. So we need to be inclusive of people that are different. And in financial services, women and people of color, LGBTQ, are on the fringes and are not necessarily part of the main structure of the decision-making historically. And we need to change that for the better of everybody. Everybody's lives improve when we actually have an inclusion principle, and when we have more people at the table discussing with different ideas and bringing more creativity and insight. And so that's why it was set up to start to connect people that were interested in that, to connect people to collaborate who are focusing on that. And we're now shifting it from not just a network, but a network that will empower young entrepreneurs and young women, where we're actually going to be putting a new CEO in place who will have 2 years to run her own initiative and her own idea and her own project, and will activate the network in order to help her succeed. And most of these projects that are coming up the pike, and she'll have 2 years, and then we'll turn it over to the next CEO to run, to build her particular initiative. They will have to do with inclusion, and they will be grounded in the principle of inclusion.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it's a really fascinating initiative and admirable initiative. And I was just going to say that, you know, the issue is probably not limited to the financial sector and the banking sector. I would imagine it's pretty well across the board in our society.
I agree with you there.
Yeah, there has been a little bit of progress, but probably not as much as at least women might like. But I've always been of a view. I mean, I've got daughters, I've got a sister, I've got a wife, and you know, I've always been of the view that hey, you know, they have a really valuable contribution to make to me. So you know, and I know they make a valuable contribution to the world. So if you exclude somebody based on gender or their beliefs or their religion, race or sexuality, whatever it might be, you're kind of excluding, you know, and if you do that across the board, you're excluding a lot of inputs that can contribute to the greater good. So really it doesn't make sense on any level at all. But, you know, we've got a long way to go on that, I think. So it's a really great initiative.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it comes down to being a human being, right? Whatever package you end up in, whatever, you know, whatever bag of bones and skin you got. And it doesn't deny the humanity in each one of us. And I think therein lies one of the things that we forget. We're all fundamentally connected at a very fundamental level. And we are having the same kind of human experience. The circumstances and the frameworks may shift a little bit. The details, you know, will definitely all be different. But essentially, we're all stuck in this life together in some way, shape, or form, and we're all experiencing it. And we're all learning. We're all having different insights. We're all shining a different facet of what humanity is. And if we exclude any one of those perspectives and facets from the discussion, we're poor for it. Yeah. And the only way we can have a full, rich life is to see and experience and connect with as many facets as possible. I think it's a crime to cut ourselves off from that sort of connection. Mm-hmm. And my driving principle is connection. That's the one thing that I cherish the most.
Yeah.
It serves me every single day. And I diversity, inclusion, those words that kind of encapsulate a movement or a principle or an idea, at their root, they're the richest thing that we could possibly give ourselves. They are what has the most capital value. It's that connectivity and connection to different people, different experiences. It's like reading a book. You read a book, you can live another lifetime. The more books that you read, the more, you know, the more lifetimes you can have. It's the same thing. The more people that we connect to, the more of those, the more life we actually get. It's a richness.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a full spherical life, right? If we polish those facets.
Absolutely. Yeah. As you pointed out, we are all connected. I mean, that's a fact. and what each one of us does impacts everyone else, essentially. So it's worth embracing that diversity and embracing the richness that it brings. So I agree with that.
Yeah, and you can make a business case for it, which, you know, for some people might be the only thing that convinces them, and I'll take it as long as they get on board and understand the value of it. I'm down with convincing by a business case.
Yeah. Well, I guess it comes back to attaching it to their why if they're not on board with why it is a good idea. All right. Well, I could go on for ages, but I'm aware of the time and it's moving on. So I thought it's time that we got onto the buzz, which is our innovation round designed to help our audience, and they're primarily innovators and leaders in their fields, with some tips from your experience. So I've got 5 questions and hopefully you'll give us some really insightful short answers that will inspire everyone to go and do something awesome today.
Let's try.
Yeah. So what's the number one thing you think anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Use the question why and ask people to question you why constantly.
So ask them to challenge you as well.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great advice. All right, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
Just that, surrounding myself with people that challenge me and that I disagree with.
Yeah.
that I fundamentally disagree with.
Okay, that's a good one. Yeah, I like that. What's your favorite tool or system for improving your productivity and allowing you to be more innovative?
Honestly, daydreaming. Scenario mapping. So I spend most of my time scenario mapping for experiments, right? So I do the same thing. There's a little bit of, I don't distract myself with anything during my commute. So I let myself wander. I tend to let myself give myself time during the day to just let my brain go and not judge where it goes and sort of daydream and play with it. I'll keep notes on those sort of things, but actually building into my day the tool of time to allow myself to just daydream.
Daydream, yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting one. And we had Dr. Fiona Kerr, a neuroscientist, on a little while ago on the podcast, and she was very strong on daydreaming and had a pretty comprehensive scientific explanation on how it actually worked and how it actually freed up part of your neurology to actually make new connections and develop new ideas. So, yeah, there is a scientific basis to it.
Good. Now I have a real reason for it, other than this.
So what's the best way to keep a project or a client on track?
I actually issue homework, and it sounds really funny, but I have in our collab program, I literally have a running spreadsheet of homework assigned to the clients with pressurized due dates, and we harass them about it. And I frame it out just like a schoolroom. These are required. This is the you'll get graded on them, and we don't get to move on to the next thing until those are done. And it's really interesting when you start to give adults who are who've left school a while ago and haven't thought about it homework and frame homework. So I give clients homework, and I couch it as homework.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. And so, do you get interesting excuses when it hasn't been done?
The dog ate my data set.
Yeah.
No, but you'd be surprised at how well they actually respond to it. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, it's good. All right. What's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Oh, this is interesting. Authenticity is important. I think that actually differentiates you. But the most important thing, I think, to differentiate yourself is to listen. I think, A, it's a lost art, but B, what you pick up from what someone says or doesn't say is different than what someone else will understand or intuit. And I think the more you listen, the more you actually differentiate yourself on the insights that you're able to glean.
That's
so really, listen.
Really good advice, yeah. So listen and see what you learn from others, because everybody's got a contribution. All right. Well, thanks for getting us through the buzz. And this has been really great, Gala. Where can people reach out and say thanks for all that you've shared today?
Oh, well, thank you, Jürgen. It's actually been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed the opportunity. I'm easily reached on Twitter, Gala Bushkovich. At Gala Bushkovich is the easiest way to find me. Same with LinkedIn. Twitter's probably the easiest. And I'm always up for a conversation. And definitely, if you want to question what I've said, I'm up for that as well.
Yeah. Well, you like to surround yourself with people that challenge you, right? So
there we go.
We'll have a link in the show notes to all those places where people can get in touch with you. And finally, who would you like me to – actually, there's one other question before I get to that one. What's the number one piece of advice you'd give to any business owner who wants to be a leader in innovation and productivity?
The first thing you need to accept are a couple of truths. One is what you supply today is not what will be in demand tomorrow, and that you need to know what you are before you know where you can compete and where you can collaborate. And one of the more important things is you need to create your own competition, that cannibalizing your own business is a very good thing. And that those who cannibalize are the ones that actually evolve and succeed and sustain themselves. But cannibalization of your own business, that's what you need to be focused on.
That's an interesting philosophy.
It's this notion of it maps back to what you do today is not what you're going to be doing tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you can't replace your current line of your current business line with something else, either tangentially related or completely, completely the inverse, then you have a limited life.
Mm.
And this is the only way to keep renewing yourself is to cannibalize what you've got. If you are starting to eat into your own profit streams, fantastic, then you've got a winner. That's what you need to be focusing on and double down on.
Yeah, and you could take the approach that if you don't do it, somebody else will.
Amen.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And it
precisely
kind of reminds me of my experience when I first started employment, which was in the photographic industry, and it was about the time when digital photography started. So, I was in film photography at the time, of course. So that could have been a philosophy that might have saved some of the film companies.
Kodak, for sure. Yeah. Cannibalize what you've got.
Yeah.
That's the best longevity medicine ever.
Yeah. Wonderful advice. All right. Then finally, who would you like me to interview on a future Innova Buzz podcast and why?
So there is this woman named Julia Streets. Julia is also in financial services. She runs her own company. They do marketing, comms, PR, and business development strategy. But what's amazing about Julia is she's been in the industry for a number of years. She has worked for some large institutions running global comms, but has been an entrepreneur herself for the last 10 years, very successful. What I know is that she's never had to hunt business. It comes to her. There's something magical about what she does. But the best part about it is she is a diversity advocate and a gigging, paid, professional comedian on top of that. Oh. She's one of the funniest people you'll ever meet, but she's got some... She knows how to run business. She knows how to build other people's businesses, and she does it with an incredible sense of humor. She's got grace about it as well. So yeah, she's one I would definitely recommend.
All right. Fascinating. So Julia, if you're listening to this, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the Innova Buzz podcast, courtesy of Gala Boscovich. It's fascinating because I think that would be the third entrepreneur and business person that's also turned to comedy in some form. So well, maybe I'm attracting those people.
I think it's a good thing, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's good young. Because, if we take ourselves too seriously, I think there's a risk that things will get on top of us. So humor is always a good way out, isn't it?
Yeah, laughter's the best medicine. And yeah. I think we all need a little medicine when we're dealing with with business.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us today on the podcast, Gala. I've really enjoyed this. I've had fun. And I've written down lots of things to think about and explore some more. So I wish you all the best for the future, and let's keep in touch.
Well, thank you, Ian. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I'm so grateful and honored that you invited me on. And we're definitely keeping in touch.
Yeah. Well, it was great to have you on. Thanks.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that delightful and insightful conversation with Gala, and like me, took a lot of ideas away. I particularly loved her take on success, that mistakes or so-called failures actually drive learning, and the insights gained from that are worthy of reward. And of course, it's the insights gained from that that are the value of having made those mistakes in the first place. Of course, there was so much more valuable information in the interview with Gala. I'd love to know what you took away from Gala's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which can be found at innovabiz.co/GalaB. That is G-H-E-L-A-B. G-H-E-L-A-B. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/GalaB. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Gala there, as well as links to her website and some of her presentations. Gala suggests that I interview Julia Streaks, another entrepreneur in the financial sector, on a future InnovaBuzz podcast. So, Julia, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the Innova Buzz podcast, courtesy of Gella Boscovich. Remember to visit innovabiz.co/VIP to access the Transformational Marketing Hub and all of its free and exceptionally useful information to help you transform your marketing. Stay connected. Head on over to iTunes or Stitcher or Pocket Casts and subscribe to the Innova Buzz podcast so you make sure you'll never miss another episode. We'd also love you to leave us a review, because what you think matters. Take some of the ideas you've heard today and apply them in your business. Any thoughts, ideas, suggestions, or questions, share them in the comments below the blog post. And remember, if you want to get better marketing results than you ever have, join our fantastic LinkedIn community at the Transformational Marketing Academy. All you have to do is go to innovabiz.co/TMAC. It's free to join. Hope to see you there soon. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember to be awesome and keep innovating.